Hi. Hey, welcome to The Cordial Catholic, a podcast for non-Catholics, new Catholics, and those looking to dig deeper into the Catholic Church. I'm K. Albert Little, a non-denominational evangelical convert to Catholicism, and this podcast is born out of one particular idea. It began for me when a Protestant pastor asked me the question, what's more important, the Bible or tradition? That led me, an evangelical in my early 20s, into a deep dive into church history. I looked into the history of the biblical canon, the formation of the Bible, history of the early church fathers. I read from the Catholic Church, and it was then, as I began to read from Catholic theologians, what the Catholic Church believed in its own words, it was then that I realized that what I thought I knew, what Catholics believed, was oftentimes based on misinformation and more often than not on simple misunderstandings. Well, this podcast serves to fill in that same gap. The gap between what you think Catholics believe and what we actually do. Each week, I have a real Catholic conversation with a real Catholic thinker from the heart of the Catholic Church. No misinformation here. And this week, I'm joined by Joe Heschmeyer. Joe is a writer, a blogger, a podcaster, and the author of Pope Peter, a brand new book from Catholic Answers Press, and we talk about the papacy. What is the papacy? What is the pope? What is his function? What isn't his function? And where did the roots of the papacy really begin? It's a fantastic conversation. It's fun. It's funny. And I think it's probably my favorite conversation I've had so far on this podcast about the pope and the papacy. It's a great introduction. It answers some fantastic questions. It lets you see the papacy in a brand new light, in my opinion. Joe's got some fantastic ideas, some wonderful perspective, and some really great answers to help clarify what the role of the Pope exactly is. It's a fantastic episode. I think you'll love it. This podcast is brought to you by my patrons at patreon.com/cordialcatholic. You guys help to underpin this show financially and to keep this thing going. So thank you from the bottom of my heart. And we have two new patrons this week. Thank you to Heidi and Mark White for your support of this show. And if you guys haven't seen Miss Heidi's Children's Liturgy of the Word on YouTube and on Catholic TV, and if you have young children, please do check that out. Heidi and Mark White are working overtime to produce this incredible children's liturgy every single Sunday during the pandemic. It, for us, has become a fantastic tradition for our family, this children's liturgy, watching this every Sunday morning, and we absolutely love it. So check that out, Children's Liturgy of the Word on Catholic TV and on YouTube, and thank you to Miss Heidi and Mark White. And now, without any further ado, here's my fantastic episode, my conversation about the papacy with Joe Heschmeyer. Please listen and enjoy. Hey guys, and welcome back to The Cordial Catholic. This is going to be a fantastic discussion. I am joined by Joe Heschmeyer. Joe is a litigator in Washington, D.C. and a seminarian for the Archdiocese of Kansas City. He now works as an instructor for the Holy Family School of Faith Institute. He's appeared in a number of different places, including Catholic Answers Magazine, The Washington Times, Word on Fire, First Things, and Strange Notions. In 2014, he was named one of Focus's 30 Under 30. He co-hosts the Catholic Podcast Weekly, and he runs the blog Shameless Popery since 2009. Joe, I'm so happy to have you on the show. Welcome to the podcast, and hello.
Hello, thank you so much for having me.
This is going to be a fantastic discussion. It's one of those things, one of those perennial kind of topics of the Catholic faith. And I want to start here at maybe a weird place, because the papacy is one of those things that I think from the outset is so misunderstood. And this show is for, well, everybody, but our listeners are normally, mainly, new Catholics, non-Catholics, and those who've been Catholic for a long time but are taking a serious, deep look into their faith. And I think starting here lays a good foundation. And where I want to start is talk about what the papacy, the Pope, is. And maybe more importantly, I think what it isn't. Because I think so often when we talk about the Pope, when people think they know what the Pope is, what they know are these misunderstandings, this misinformation about the Pope, and they think that when Pope Francis speaks on an airplane to a reporter from an Italian paper, what he's saying is in quote-unquote, the gospel truth, right? Which often isn't the case. So what isn't the Pope? What is it not meant to be that sometimes we think, or non-Catholics or Catholics who've grown up Catholic think that he is? What is he not meant to be? Let's start there.
Yeah. Okay, great. Well, I think a couple things. I think the first thing you just kind of hinted at, the Pope isn't an apostle. He's not an oracle, and he's not always right on everything. Now, that sounds like an attack on Pope Francis, or it sounds like an attack on the papacy, but that's actually what the Catholic Church has always taught about the popes, that there was a position held by some Catholics that the Pope was infallible in everything he said or everything he did. And that's not what the Church teaches, and it's not what Vatican I taught. Vatican I gives particular parameters under which the Pope speaks infallibly. Now, those aren't the only times he speaks infallibly, but the mere fact that they're giving a specific instance of cases in which he does speak infallibly shows that their understanding is not everything he says and does is infallible, or else that would be a very strange kind of exercise in futility. If what they meant to say is everything the Pope says and does is perfect, spotless, inspired, well, that would be a much easier thing to say. So that's the first thing that the Pope isn't, or the papacy isn't. The second is that the papacy doesn't automatically mean the Pope is a saint. And if you look at the history of the Church, of the 264 dead popes, only a fraction of them are canonized. And I think that's just an important thing to keep in mind, that just like we're not saying everything the Pope says and does publicly is perfect, nor are we saying the Pope is personally without sin or without fault. I mean, go back to the example in Galatians 2, where St. Paul confronts St. Peter. Peter's gospel is right. Peter is the first one to preach about the equality and the inclusion of the Gentiles in the gospel. We see this in Acts 10 and Acts 11. But he doesn't practice what he preaches, and we see him having a sort of treatment of the Gentile Christians as second-class Christians in Galatians 2. And so Paul stands up to him, and he's right to do so. So in terms of personal conduct, in terms of personal holiness, there is no guarantee that the Pope will always be a saint. And if you know anything about the history of the papacy, there seem to be some obvious examples of ones who might not fit that mold. And I think the third thing, the Pope isn't always the Church's greatest theologian. Obviously, it's great if the Pope is a very clear thinker and a clear speaker. The Pope is also not always the Church's greatest preacher. There are plenty of popes who were terribly introverted, or who maybe weren't great speakers or preachers. Some popes who were very, very learned, some popes who weren't very learned at all. And the list goes on. Like, basically, it's great if the Pope is a brilliant theologian. It's great if the Pope is a great pastor. It's great if the Pope is a great preacher. But those things are not necessary conditions for the office, nor the guarantees of the office. That is by no means an exhaustive list of what the papacy isn't. But I want to add one more at the very end, which is the Pope is not a dictator. So oftentimes, when I'm talking with especially Protestant brothers and sisters, they'll say things like, well, if the papacy was true in the early Church, why didn't Peter single-handedly solve the Judaizer controversy in Acts 15 instead of having the Council of Jerusalem solve it? Or why do we see any other apostles at all? And so on. And that would be akin to saying, well, why was there the Council of Trent? Or why was there Vatican I or Vatican II if there's a Pope at those times? But of course, we know there was a Pope at those times. So anyone who understands the papacy as to the exclusion of other legitimate teaching office or authority in the Church misunderstands what the Church has always taught about the papacy. And I think what the Bible teaches about the papacy.
Those are such good points. And I think so important. You know this, in philosophy and theology, in discussions about anything, you've got to define your terms and lay down what you're talking about. And I think so oftentimes when you're speaking about the papacy, even amongst in Catholic circles, you're talking about different things based on the understanding that people have about what that thing is. But there is clear teaching, what the Church teaches about what the Pope is. I think that's so important to understand right from the get-go. So that's what a Pope is not. Can we talk about, I don't want to exhaust this just yet, I want to go more into the origin of the papacy and these kinds of things, but in general terms, what is the papacy then? Like, what is its purpose? What is it doing there? Because again, we're often discussing different things when we talk about the Pope and don't understand exactly what it is. We're talking about different things here. And let's lay a bit more groundwork here. What is the Pope then?
Yeah, so the Pope has a few critical, I would say, central roles. And the first is to serve as some of the Eastern Church Fathers called an icon of unity for the church. It's a visible sign of being in union with the body of Christ. That if you're in union with the Pope, then you know you're in union with the church founded by Christ. That's a pretty awesome kind of role. And there's no other bishop who can say that, because any other bishop could go into schism. So you might be in communion with your particular bishop, but your bishop is a schismatic or is an excommunicate or fill in the blanks. And in the history of the church, we see this plenty of times, most obviously in the case now with Eastern Orthodoxy. That would be the first thing. The Pope is an icon of unity. Since we are called by Christ to both persevere in orthodoxy and to all be united as he and the Father are united. This is John 17. The only way to do that is to have unity in the truth. And this is one of the things I actually talk about in the book, Pope Peter, that there, from the Protestant perspective, you always have to choose between unity and truth. I quote a Methodist scholar, Ben Witherington, who talks about this. He says, from the Protestant perspective, Catholics choose unity at the sake of truth, and Protestants choose truth at the sake of unity. Well, the first thing to notice here is Christ commands both. So if you're trying to have truth and giving up unity, you're trying to have truth by giving up truth. Because part of the truth of the gospel is that all Christians are called to be one as Christ and the Father are one. It's very explicit. John 17, verse 20 to 23 is the only time we see Jesus explicitly praying for future generations of Christians. And what he's praying for is that we won't divide. And so if Protestants are just ignoring that and openly dividing and treating it like it doesn't matter, they are openly violating the one thing he specifically told them not to do and us not to do, right? So you can't give up unity for the sake of truth, but neither can you give up truth for the sake of unity. So you need to have, logically, some way of being united in the truth. The Pope, as the icon of unity, is that way. Whatever the Pope is teaching, by definition, cannot be heretical in the sense, in this very limited sense. If the Pope says you have to believe X to be part of the church and X is heretical, then you as a believer are forced into choosing heresy or schism. And then you've been forced into an impossible choice since Christ has forbidden both avenues. So the whole, when we talk about papal infallibility, the big mistake is thinking that it's some sort of personal charism of the Pope for his own edification or sanctification. That it's just about the Pope being so smart or so holy or being protected from making mistakes. And it's not that. The point of papal infallibility is that the Holy Spirit is promising we will never have to choose to disobey Christ in one way or disobey him in the other, because that is an impossible moral quandary for him to put us in. That's a pretty low bar in a way, right? Like, there's a lot of things the Pope can still do wrong, but we know he will never force us to go into heresy or go into schism. And as low as that bar is, you see tons of Christians not meet it, right? Like, you see tons of Christians who say, no, we do have to go into schism, or we do have to go into this new set of beliefs that you think are heretical. And so it sounds like ridiculously low, but just think about how many people aren't meeting that bar. And you see, it's actually pretty meaningful that you can believe what's dogmatically taught by the church. You can believe whatever is required for membership in the church, and you can know it's true because the alternative is that God has basically set us up in a trap that we can't get out of.
That's fantastic. So an icon of unity. I love that. And I mean, for me, listeners of this show for a long time know that John 17 for me was a huge issue for me becoming Catholic as an evangelical. It was enormous. So an icon for unity, that's fundamental. What else is the Pope meant to be?
So I sort of hinted at this second step, which is that the Pope is kind of, I don't want to say exactly like a court of high appeal or like the highest court of appeal, you know, like the Supreme Court here in the U.S. But there is a sense in which there's a final judicial aspect that the Pope can play. We also see ecumenical councils play this. And there's a reason those two organs of the church play this, which is that in Matthew 16, we see Peter specifically get the binding and loosening power. And in Matthew 18, we see the whole church collectively get binding and loosening power. And so when I have talked to, again, mostly Protestants, sometimes Orthodox, mostly Protestants, about these passages, Oftentimes it's read as a sort of redundancy. Like, well, first Jesus gave this to Peter, but then he gave it to everyone. So now Peter doesn't have anything special. That seems to me to be a very bad way to read the Bible, because it means this whole section in Matthew, in Matthew 16, you could just skip it, because it doesn't mean anything new that isn't about to be done in Matthew 18. But another way to look at it is, given that Jesus is going to give the binding and loosening power in Matthew 18 to the church collective, why does he give it to Peter specifically? And I think if you want to understand that, one of the ways to go is to look at what the Jewish understanding of binding and loosening is or was. And it involved this idea that certain governing bodies within Judaism could have infallible, divinely protected kind of adjudication of matters of like the law, for instance. And there's allusions to this throughout the New Testament. Some fascinating ones. For instance, in Matthew 23, when Jesus talks about the Pharisees, he says they sit on the seat of Moses, and so do whatever they teach, but don't practice what they're actually doing, because they don't practice what they preach. And so he basically treats their judgments as binding. And this idea of the chair of Moses, well, the Latin for that is cathedra, where we get words like cathedral. So that's where we get the phrase ex cathedra, to mean like when the Pope is speaking from the chair of Peter. We don't literally mean he has to sit in a magic chair to do that. We mean like in the authority, in the office of Peter. And it's this fascinating reference to this, like the only time we see that idiom in the New Testament is in Matthew 23, applied to the Pharisees, which shows you that you don't have to be personally holy to exercise it, because Jesus is talking about the Pharisees exercising it. We also see this in the treatment of the high priest, though, in a couple places. Look at the way Paul is deferential to the high priest when he realizes that the person he spoke against was the high priest. He didn't recognize him. He apologizes. That's in Acts. But in the Gospel of John, there's the most fascinating of the references, which is that the high priest is said to have prophesied by the Holy Spirit because he was high priest that year. That's what John says. This is in, I believe, John 11, when they're plotting the death of Jesus after the raising of Nicodemus. Lazarus, there it is. The raising of Lazarus. Nicodemus is the one who sort of stands up for Jesus in this body. But the high priest saying it's better for one man to die for the sake of the people. John says that this is guided by the Holy Spirit because he's high priest. All of that is to say, the Jewish understanding, the Christian understanding that we see throughout the New Testament, that's mentioned pretty explicitly by John and is alluded to both by Luke and Acts and by Jesus in Matthew's gospel, is this idea that God will protect the highest governing body of his people, because otherwise there would have been no way to keep kosher. If you've got the highest bodies in Judaism giving you contrary instructions for how to follow the law, that you can't do both, then you're just in an impossible position, and no one can live by the law, and no one can do the things that God has commanded them to do. And so there was this idea that God wouldn't put them in that spot. And binding and loosening was the way idiomatically that this was referred to. So when Jesus uses that and applies it to Peter, that means infallibility. And any Jew who's familiar with this would know that. In the book, I actually cite to the Jewish Encyclopedia and give pretty concrete examples showing like this was an understood, well-recognized phrase. We're approaching it now with Gentile ears saying, what does this mean to us? And it's like, wrong question, because we're not dealing with the Gentile audience at the time Jesus says this. So the idea of papal infallibility is baked right in there. And if I could add one more thing, I know this is a very long answer, but in Luke 22, which is actually my favorite passage about the papacy, Jesus says, in a nutshell, when the apostles at the Last Supper are arguing about which of them is the greatest, Jesus says power is for service, and he gives himself as an example that he's the greatest among them, and he's there as one who serves. He's one who serves at table rather than who sits at table. This is, again, where he has the famous washing of the feet in John's gospel. So he's presenting himself as a servant leader, to use kind of the modern parlance. That's his idea of what leadership is going to look like, as opposed to the leadership of the Gentiles, which is like a leadership of domination. Immediately after this, he then does two things. He affirms that the disciples, the 12, will continue to have a governing sort of authority even into heaven. He talks about the thrones in heaven set aside for them. And then he says to one of them, Simon, Simon, Satan has desired to sift all of you like wheat, but I have prayed for you, Simon, that your faith may not fail. And when you have turned back, strengthen your brethren. Now that is a very clear call within the 12 that one of them is to be a servant leader, even of the other 11. that's where we get the phrase, my favorite phrase for the Pope, is servant of the servants of God. That's what that's coming from, Luke 22. So that's the third thing. So to recap, the Pope is an icon of unity. He has the binding and loosening power to settle and adjudicate disputes, and he's to be a servant and leader to the people of God, and especially even to the other bishops.
That's just fantastic. And I guess one question mark might be, and I've encountered this, when if Jesus is in the head of the church, if he's the head of the Christian church, as I believe, as an evangelical, I mean, I saw no need for a pope because I was evangelical, Protestant Christian. I had my Bible. I had Jesus. He was kind of the head, even though he wasn't on earth anymore. The Holy Spirit was what he sent to guide us. What need was there, I mean, for a pope as this? I mean, we call him, as Catholics, a vicar of Christ. What need was there for a vicar of Christ? Somebody, I guess unity is a good answer. You've already given that. Is there more to say on that? Because I see a place for a bit of pushback. Like, well, why is that really even necessary? If Jesus is the head of the church, why have a pope in charge on earth?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. And I think a good way to go about addressing it, usually like in a one-on-one context, one of the first things I'd want to find out in this situation is what the person thinks about the role of Peter in the New Testament. Because most Protestants will acknowledge there's some kind of leadership authority Peter has. You have to be pretty blind to all of these passages, like where Peter's always listed first among the apostles, when Acts describes the 12 as Peter and the 11, when Luke describes the transfiguration, that Peter, James, and John are there, he calls it Peter and the others. Like, these kind of references suggest that Peter has some sort of primacy, and a primacy that isn't just first among equals. He seems to be given something even above and beyond the other apostles. Well, Peter is the person who has the, or I guess, you know, at the time of Peter, it's the time you would have the least need to have human leadership other than Jesus, because Jesus is there. So why do we have a leader of the apostles other than Jesus when Jesus is walking among the apostles? I think if you can press on that issue, then you start to understand that, oh, okay, Peter's leadership isn't a threat to Jesus. Jesus is constantly seen cultivating this leadership and cultivating what could properly be called a headship within the 12. And among the apostolic church. So that'd be the first thing I say. Just like looking at the biblical evidence, we can see that it happens before we get into the why does it happen. So the second thing is the idea of Peter kind of as a vicar. One of my favorite passages to deal with this is an obscure passage in the Gospel of Matthew that's a miraculous catch of fish. Now, most people can remember two catches of fish. One is in Luke's gospel, where there's the famous scene where Peter and others, other apostles, three other apostles, are out, and Jesus sends them out into the deep. They have a miraculous catch of fish. Jesus says to Peter, you'll be a fisher of men. Already, Peter's being singled out even among the other apostles. The other miraculous catch of fish people usually remember is in the last chapter of John's gospel, where we see Peter and six other apostles. And in this one, it's pretty fascinating because there's a miraculous catch of fish. All of them together can't bring the net in, but Jesus commands and Peter single-handedly brings it to the shore to Jesus. And this was recognized as an image of the church throughout history, the church throughout the world, approaching the eternal shores of heaven. Like, if you read what the church fathers say about the last chapter of John's gospel, it seems to be almost like a mystical vision in which Jesus sees the church. Now, remember, in Matthew 13, he describes the church as a net containing many fish, and the net is untorn, and the Greek word there is schism. It doesn't have schism because Peter is leading it to the shores where Jesus is. So you see that that is why, like, Peter's headship isn't in rivalry to Jesus, because it's only at the command of Jesus that Peter can do it. Peter couldn't do it by himself, even with six other guys. At Jesus' command, Peter can do it by himself. That's not a rivalry. That's Christ living through Peter and in Peter in this unique kind of singular way. Oh, well, I didn't even mention the other miraculous catch of fish. It was the one I was going to mention. There, yeah, in Matthew's gospel, there is the temple tax. So they come for the temple tax, and all the apostles have been with Jesus, and they approach Peter, and they ask Peter if Jesus is going to pay the tax. Notice they're already treating him as the vicar of Christ. They're already treating him as someone who can answer questions on Jesus' behalf while Jesus is on earth. And Peter says, yeah, he's going to pay the tax. And then he goes back and checks with Jesus to see if that was the right answer, which is pretty fascinating. And Jesus does not upbraid him for, like, speaking out of turn or anything like that. Instead, he says, on whom should the tax fall? The sons or on foreigners? And he says, foreigners. Now, there's an important thing to know here. The temple tax had only a small handful of categories of exemptions. It was a tax that the Jews had to pay, but it was not a tax that priests had to pay because it was about the maintenance of the temple. And so in claiming to be a son, he's not saying a son of Israel because the sons of Israel is who the tax is on. He's claiming to be a son of the temple. He's claiming to be a priest. And he's claiming this not only for himself, but for Peter. And how do we know this? Because he then goes and has Peter have a miraculous catch of fish with just a coin large enough to pay for the temple tax of Jesus and Peter, and that's it. The one other dimension in that miracle, Jesus refers to it as so that we do not give scandal, so that we do not give offense. And this is the only time he uses what's called the inclusionary we. Like he means we, like me and another human being. It's the only time in all of the Gospels he unites himself with the person he's speaking to in the first person plural. Every other time he uses the we, it's to separate himself from the person he's talking to remind the other person that he's radically unlike them, because he's constantly helping people not forget his divinity, his unique ontological status before the Father, and so on. With Peter, he unites himself in this we. So when you see the Pope using the old papal we, that's solidly biblical. Like that is coming straight from Jesus's mouth. That isn't just like some sort of papal arrogance or something like that. So there's a lot there, right? But it is this idea that Peter is being given the ability to speak and act, and he's tethered to Jesus in this really unique kind of wonderful way. The very last thing, if I can add one more scripture on top of that, is that in Matthew 16, I alluded to it before, Jesus gives the keys to the kingdom to Simon Peter. Well, the keys to the kingdom, if you're familiar with Isaiah 22, Eliakim is made the head of the household and made a vicar for the king. And the way this is bestowed is in the handing on of the keys. And so when Peter is given the keys, he's given the same sort of authority very clearly. And so going back to like the Old Testament, Eliakim is able to speak and act in the person of the king. When a foreign power comes to Israel and wants to speak to the king, Eliakim goes out there. So it's that kind of idea. A vicarship is very clearly included in this idea of the administration and one of the powers of the keys.
Joe, I'm convinced. You've got me. That's amazing. And there is so much in there. I'm going to have to rewind this, listen back to my own show to gather my thoughts here. That's just incredible. So much information in there. And it's not as if the Catholic idea of the papacy just cherry picks one or two things out of the Gospels or the account of the life of Jesus. This is this enormous, beautiful, poetic tapestry that is created here. Not one or two things we're finding to say, hey, look, this is why the Pope is important or why we believe that Christ established the papacy. It is weaved throughout the entire Gospel narratives, right? And I want to ask you this, and this I think, well, maybe you've already answered this, but I'm sure you have more to say. And this is a bit of a wind up here, so hold on. Take a deep breath. I have a good friend, Austin, who is an evangelical theology student at Moody Bible Institute. And I had him on my show a few episodes ago, and he's got a great YouTube channel called Gospel Simplicity. And part of what he's doing on there is exploring Catholicism from an evangelical perspective. And that's, of course, right up my alley. I'm an evangelical convert to Catholicism myself. And so we had a great conversation on this show. And one of the truly profound things that he said was something that I came to understand before I became Catholic. And I'm going to paraphrase here, but it was the idea that everything in Catholicism, the Marian dogmas, the church's tradition, the liturgy, the sacraments, the priesthood, everything rises and falls with the church's claim to authority. If they get the authority right, well, then everything else falls into place. And funny enough, I had Mark Galley. He's the former editor-in-chief of Christianity Today, the giant evangelical magazine, and recently a convert to Catholicism and pretty high-profile convert. I had him on my show following Austin, I think the following week, and he said almost exactly the same thing, the same reason that he kind of mentions this. And it's this church's claim to authority, as it says, to bind and loose, that kind of everything rises and falls with. If it has that authority, which obviously I came to believe that it does, then everything else it says and teaches, well, it just follows. So here's my super long-winded lead up to the question, Joe. That authority to bind and loose ultimately rests in a special way with the Pope. So to those evangelicals like myself at one point who have come to see the crux of the Catholic Church's claim to authority as the thing and the papacy as the ultimate thing they have to kind of buy into before everything else falls into place, what would you make as the best case to believe in that claim, to believe in the Pope? And maybe you've already answered this, but I'm sure you have more to flesh out there. What's kind of your number one claim that you would want to say, hey, this is why that authority rests here. This is why I believe in the Pope.
Yeah. First of all, I think I'd say that is a fantastic question. And I would applaud the person who's getting to that point for recognizing that it really does come down to the papacy. And it really does come down to this question of, is there some earthly way of knowing what the Bible means? Would be another way of asking that. Is there an earthly way of knowing what the Bible means? Or are we each left up to our own best guess? Now, when I say that, I don't mean to fault. Like, there's a ton of time and effort and energy and brilliance and human ingenuity that goes into biblical interpretation on the Protestant and on the Orthodox sides of the aisle. I mean, some of the brightest minds in Christianity are over there. And they're doing fantastic work. But this is, I'm not even going to go with a Bible verse first. I'm going to go with just a pretty logical case. If you reject the idea of a papacy, then you pretty well have to commit yourself to the idea that orthodoxy is this kind of intangible thing that can never be totally reached. And here's what I mean by that. You have to accept the premise that the entire visible church, at least in theory, could be wrong on something as important as the core of the gospel. And so, for instance, forensic justification, one of the critical doctrines of the Reformation, is not found in any of the church fathers. It's not found in any writings in the first 1500 years. Some people read it in St. Paul, but that's begging the question. The question is it properly found in St. Paul? And 1500 years straight, nobody saw it there. And so it's only in the 16th century that you have people start to make this case. Now, this is not just like a Catholic claiming this, like Alistair McGrath, who believes in forensic justification, and Justitia Dei mentions this and says, like, yeah, this is a theological novum of the 16th century. Like, this is a novelty. This is a thing that wasn't believed in for 1500 years. But you have Protestants say this is essential to be a Christian. It is essential as part of the gospel. And so you'd have to say by logical, like the extension of that is, everyone who gave us the Bible for 1500 years was heretical. And at that point, Christianity becomes kind of a joke. Meaning this, like, if I asked you, well, why do you have these books in your Bible? And you said, well, these are the books the Mormons had. And then I just took out a few and these were the ones left over. I'd be like, that is an insane way, as someone who thinks Mormons are heretical, that you would come up with your own like holy book, right? But the Protestant approach to the canon has largely been to say, now, again, you've got a wide variety. So I'm going to speak in a broad generality here. I know it's a generality, and I want to like call that out initially. You've got a lot of Protestants who say the Catholic views on X, Y, and Z doctrines are actually heretical. That they aren't just like, this is a disagreement of opinion within the umbrella of orthodoxy. They're going to say these views are actually heretical. But if you press, like, why do you have your Bible? It's kind of like, well, it ends up being some long-winded way of getting to this was the Catholic Bible and then we took out seven books, which would be like saying we took the Book of Mormon, cut out the last few books, and then like this is what was left over. And that's insanity, right? Like, if you can't trust these people to get the basics of the gospel right, then you can't trust them to get the canon right. You can't trust them to get anything right. So it becomes this really weird, impersonal way of approaching Christianity, that God's going to protect the books and not the people. That he's going to protect the books from error and let the people fall into error? Like, what is the point of that? And if they fell into error for 1500 years, there is no reason on God's green earth to believe that it didn't happen for 2000 years or for the next 20,000 years. Like, there's no reason to believe that there's any orthodoxy or ever has been orthodoxy. So once you reject the idea that we can know with certainty what is and isn't orthodox beyond just this is my best read of this document, then you've really thrown out the ability to be orthodox and to live in a sane kind of way. And that's not just a Catholic saying it. This is why the Jews believed the Sanhedrin was protected by God, by the Spirit of God. This is why they believed the high priest was protected, because the alternative is just insanity. And so when Jesus says that he's praying for everyone to be one, I've talked to so many Protestants about, like, maybe one day we'll get to unity. Guys, like, there are more denominations every year than there were the year before. That there is no sign of that trend stopping, and there's no logical reason why it would. Because to become one, everyone would have to read the documents the exact same way, and we can't even do that on the Constitution. And I'm using a very American example to a Canadian, I know. But, like, we can't even do that on, like, basic legal matters where you have, like, one law, oftentimes while the lawmakers are still alive. You can't even get everyone to agree on what the law says. And you're going to take an entire thousands of years of divine revelation and expect everyone to agree to be able to come up with what orthodoxy is? That is insanity, right? So that'd be the first way I'd go. It's just like, okay, so the real question here is, can anyone be orthodox? Or are we just left to our best guess? Because the logical conclusion of Protestantism is relativism. The logical conclusion of Protestantism is this kind of no moral code can really be known for certain. And then we're just left with nothing. It's an attempt to save the Bible from the church. And in, as a result, you end up with losing the Bible and the church in a real way.
Yeah, I don't want to get too far afield, but I mean, this is absolutely, absolutely fundamentally important to underscore with big lines and highlight and whatever you want to do. I once wrote a blog article way back when in my conversion experience, something to do with the Protestant system is broken, because I was struggling as somebody looking into the Catholic faith to go, okay, well, if this isn't right, then what do I believe? And then looking really deeply at my beliefs founded in the Bible to find that there's just no consensus. And here I am struggling against all these other interpretations of things, like huge things, salvation, baptism, like what communion was, these really big issues, not little small things. And I thought, I'm praying as hard as I can. I'm reading my scriptures. I'm praying for insight. I am doing everything that I've been taught to do as an evangelical. And the Holy Spirit is supposed to guide me in understanding. If this is, and there's supposed to be a plain meaning in here, this is what we were taught. Why can I not get to the same conclusion as this guy in the same church as me sometimes, not even different denominations? And like you said, I would look at John 17 and go, and I felt like you are describing, well, one day we'll get together. One day we'll be united again. Yet, as you said very poignantly, Joe, every day a new denomination is created and we're getting further from that unity, not closer in any sense. And I thought, okay, if this is a system that God established, he can't be a very good God if he is letting us suffer through this stuff. Like, okay, you've told us that we can be one, but look how hard this seems to be. And I was taught this hermeneutic of understanding the Bible as I can read it and know in a plain sense, meaning that this is what it means. Yet I can't do that because we aren't agreeing on these things. And we're all, you know, in a Bible study of say, 10 evangelical people, we're all praying as hard as we can and really trying to let those barriers go down between our hearts and Christ and be open and honest and humble and docile. And we can't get there. We can't get to the same place. So that's where I came to see, as you're saying here in this very first point of yours, which I love, Joe, you need something else.
Yeah, one of the things I think you just mentioned, I'm really glad you did, which is that this is not just like hard-heartedness or idiocy or intentional heresy or something on the part of Protestants. Like, you can take the best minds and the people who will give anything for Christ and find this problem replicated. So, for instance, you know William Lane Craig, the Christian apologist? He's a heretic. He's a monothelite. He believes that there's only one will in Christ. He denies that there's a distinct human will. This is an old school heresy. And his mentor, Norm Geisler, another the recently deceased Norm Geisler, just died last year, another one of these huge names in evangelical Christianity. These are two of the best philosophers within or without of evangelicalism. They disagree, and each views the other one's position as heretical. And any reasonable Christian is going to look and say, I'm not as well as read as those guys. I'm not as smart as those guys. I'm probably not as holy as those guys. And yet one of them's a heretic. And it's up to me to know which one. Like, that is an insane burden. And that's just two guys. Multiply that problem now to a billion. And you see, like, this is a real problem. That, you know, there's a reason you and the guys in your Bible study can't come to one meaning that this definitely has, where you might take not just different interpretations, but contradictory ones. And that's a huge problem. Second thing. So it's not just like a problem. Like I said, this is smart people. This is holy people. This is not a problem on the level of the individual. This is a problem on the level of the hermeneutic. Like this system of this approach to the Bible, assuming the meaning is plain, assuming the meaning will be clear to you, and assuming that everyone's going to agree on the meaning, has never worked. It's never worked. Going back to the 19th century, there's a guy by the name of Norman Fox, who was a Baptist at William Jewell College, which is not far from Kansas City here. And he wrote this bizarre book arguing for a new view of the Lord's Supper, basically saying everyone had gotten it wrong. And he said, you know, he poses a question. Well, do you really mean to say the whole church has been in error for so many centuries? And Fox is sly as a fox. And he said, well, quote, the Baptists do not hesitate to declare that nearly the whole church fell into error regarding the subjects of baptism. The Presbyterians affirm the same regarding orders in the ministry, and the Congregationalists make the same assertions concerning church government. He goes on from there to say, well, right now, we all reject like what Catholics believe about the real presence and what the early church believed about the real presence, and we take like four different views that are contradictory right now. So his point is like, yeah, my view might seem crazy, but it's no crazier than the rest of Protestantism. And he's right. Like, once you accept that any of those are possibilities, like everybody got baptism wrong, everybody got holy orders wrong, everybody got the structure of the church wrong, everybody got the papacy wrong. Like, once you get down that road, there's really no turning back, and you have to say literally anything goes. So you can have a brilliant apologist for Christianity who rejects basic Christology, and is probably only a half step further to get someone who rejects basic Trinitarian theology, because Trinity and Christology are like the heart of orthodoxy, and William Lane Craig only checks one of those two boxes.
So what else? I mean, that's a great claim. That right there is a logical claim to the necessity of the Pope. Where would you go from there?
Yeah, I would look at, take a broad view of the whole history of salvation. Like, I'm intentionally not just saying this verse here says this. I'm saying, look at the big picture, right? Like, look at the way God works through one guy, or occasionally through one woman in the Judges. And it's over and over and over again. You've got the patriarchs, you've got the prophets, you've got the kings, you've got the judges. I've got that out of chronological order, I know. But you got the basic idea that it's always this like single person kind of headship. Now, there might be a structure beneath that. For instance, Jethro goes to Moses and has set up this whole structure of like a judicial structure with Moses as the highest judicial office. That's pretty darn similar to the way the church is set up right now. But notice that, if you will, there's kind of a triangular-shaped structure to all of God's approaches to governance of his people. He never just creates some sort of democratic assembly. The only time we see democracy in the Old or New Testament is when the people choose Barabbas over Jesus. This is not because they don't know about democracy, right? Like, the Greeks already had, they tried democracy and it failed. So when Jesus comes, he doesn't proclaim the People's Democratic Republic of God. He proclaims the Kingdom of God. And yes, he is the head of that. But also, this headship is exercised in this vicar kind of way. So even if you said, oh, there's no head, you should expect the rest of that pyramid short of Jesus as the head. And that's not what Protestantism has, right? Like, you should expect it to be basically a headless pyramid by saying, well, our head's in heaven. So you have something like the back of the dollar, right? Or another American reference. But like, the back of the U.S. dollar has like a headless pyramid. So you would expect that. But in reality, like from the earliest days of the church, you see this very clear sense that there's one bishop per city, and that Rome has this special authority even over the other cities. It's a pyramid-shaped structure. So throughout the Old Testament, throughout what appears to be going on in the New Testament, throughout the early church, on down through today, you see this kind of triangular-shaped structure. That is at least going to have the presumption of being correct, right? Because at least matches up with everything else God has done. And we shouldn't expect that he's going to like radically break from that without giving us like sufficient evidence that he's going to be doing something radically different than he's always done. And we don't see that evidence, because if we did, like if he actually intended a democracy, you would expect to find something like that. Or if he, you know, and then in addition to that, I might add in that when he describes the church, he doesn't, for instance, in talking about shepherd and sheep, he talks about in John 10, Jesus says that he's a good shepherd and that he's going to call together the Jews and the Gentiles. So there's one flock with one shepherd. But he also says in the first 10 verses in that, he gives another metaphor where he refers to himself as the sheep gate by which the true shepherd will come. The shepherd will come through the gate. So in John 21, after that, the scene I mentioned before where they bring the fish ashore, they have breakfast. And then Jesus takes Peter aside, apart from six other apostles, and says to him, Simon, do you love me more than these? Simon, do you love me? Simon, do you love me? And then he says to him, feed my sheep, tend my sheep, feed my lambs. And so he's making him very explicitly one shepherd for his sheep. Now, this was promised repeatedly in the Old Testament that this would happen. In Isaiah 66, we have a prophecy that the Gentiles will be incorporated into the people of God, and some of them will be taken as priests and Levites. In Jeremiah 3:15, we have this promise that God will create shepherds after his own heart. So you have this promise of true, like, shepherds leading the people of God. Well, think about the org chart, so to speak, of a shepherd and sheep. It isn't like a huge panel of shepherds. Nor is it the modern circumstance that we have in the West, which is, you know, each of us figures out what we individually believe first, and then we find a church that matches up with that belief. That gets it all backwards, right? Like, then we shepherd ourselves until we find some other flock we can, like, hang out with. But we've formed ourselves. We've educated ourselves. We've led ourselves to wherever we're going to go. And if I and the pastor disagree, I just go on to the next flock. I only know the American stat here. I don't know the Canadian stat, but in the U.S., over 50% of Protestants switch denominations before they die. So this idea of just switching flocks is rampant. It's widespread. It's more the norm than the exception right now. That clearly breaks the idea of a shepherd and sheep. Like, all that whole relationship has gotten inverted and thrown out of whack in some pretty fundamental ways. So I say the papacy is much more in line with the description we get from Jesus and the role of Peter in that. And it's also much more in line with, like, the overall structure of salvation history.
Yeah. And even as you're saying that, I'm thinking of Matthew 18, when Jesus talks about how to deal with the dispute in the church. And the idea is that, you know, you bring somebody else, you bring another person, you go and tell the church, and if the person refuses to listen to you, then they're a Gentile or tax collector, and they're kind of out of the church. That, again, is as you say, kind of putting you as the shepherd of your own kind of flock there. And I remember, as I was on my conversion journey looking at the Catholic Church, I brought this verse to my non-denominational evangelical pastor, and I said, help me. Like, what does this mean? Because if you tell me that you disagree with me on a certain passage of the Bible, then I can just go down the street to a different church that believes what I believe about this, and I can find a home there. So how am I ever really out of this church? Like, how does this thing that Jesus tells us is how it's going to work, how is that ever applicable if all these churches believe different things? Like, there has to be some kind of structure that I can be thrown out of if I don't agree with it. There has to be a way of knowing that I'm on the outs with the church. And in our structure, there wasn't a way of doing that. And the response of my pastor, he's a fantastic guy, I love him, but he had no response. It was like, well, I don't know. Because what do you say? And that, right, like you say, it doesn't look like what Jesus established, because I am then, I'm my own shepherd. I can go down the street to a different church and join that flock that agrees with me, that agrees with my interpretation of whatever the problem is that we're dealing with, right? I mean, that was a...
Yeah. And yeah, this is the thing that's so wild about it. I think you hit the nail squarely on the head. Because it does, it takes any kind of teeth out of any judicial aspect the church has. And I guess it's probably worth pointing out the obvious, which is that's not the way the church operates in Acts. Or it's not the way the church operates throughout the New Testament. In 1 Corinthians, when you've got the guy thrown out of the church for living an immoral lifestyle, there's no sense in which he goes to another church down the block, because there isn't one. He's just out of the church. And then he has to be reconciled to the church. And then Paul has to, like, write them to tell them, like, let him back in, be, you know, let him be forgiven. That kind of idea, there's no room for that in Protestantism if you don't view your church as the church. If you view it as a church and there's 20 other A churches in the town, well, yeah, there's no teeth to that. They can just go down the street. And more than that, if you listen to the way Jesus describes it, you know, you described, that's a great example from Matthew 18. The church needs to have this adjudicating authority. Now, notice within that, there's two things implicit. One, the church here needs to be visible, because if a non-visible church can't go to. And two, the church needs to be structured in such a way it can render a kind of decision. There's a judicial power to the church. I would point you as well to Matthew 5 in the Sermon on the Mount, when Jesus says, "You are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hid, nor do men light a lamp and put it under a bushel, but on a stand, and it gives light to all in the house. Let your light shine before men, so they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven." Two things to notice about this. First of all, it is by definition visible. In fact, he's very clear that you need to let your light shine before men. Like, an invisible light totally rips any meaning out of the passage. Second, it's structured. It's a city. It's a society. So when St. Robert Bellarmine says that the church is a visible society as visible as the Republic of Venice, another way of saying that would be the church is as visible as Israel because of visible people of God. There is this idea, very popular in modern Protestant theology and modern Protestant ecclesiology, that in the Old Testament you had a visible people of God, now you have an invisible people of God. That the church is the collection of all the saved, wherever they may be, but no one really knows where that is because that's only known to God. And that is not at all what Jesus ever says about the church. You will search in vain for anything that so much as hints at that kind of understanding of the church. That's based on some bad 15th century theology from Jan Hus and John Wycliffe. And one of the arguments they were making is that this would allow us to say that bad priests and bishops weren't really members of the church. Well, this poses enormous problems for understanding the New Testament, because one of the things, and to his credit, Wycliffe says this outright. He says Judas wasn't a bishop of the church. He wasn't an actual officer of the church. That's a huge problem because you can read Jesus say that he's one of the 12. You see Jesus directly appointing him as one of the 12. You see St. Paul saying in 1 Corinthians that the apostles are by definition part of the body of Christ. They're by definition part of the church. And you see at the end of John's gospel, Jesus say, "Did I not call you 12 and one of you is a devil?" Hard to get around that, right? So you basically have to say everything that Jesus says about the visibility of the church and the structure of the church is wrong to take the Protestant view of the church broadly. And so, you know, I would say that's some more fundamental error before you even get into the papacy, is there's some really fundamental errors being made on what is the church all about. And that I cover that a little bit in chapter 2 and chapter 3 of the book. Chapter 2 just says, what are the major Protestant views? Why don't they work? Chapter 3 says, what does Jesus say about a city on a hill? What does he say about the church? And how is this understood by the earliest Christians as well? And you can see that, like, the papacy makes sense in the context of the church. I think this is a really important point to make, though, because to say St. Peter is the head of the church doesn't mean the same thing to two different people if they don't have the same understanding of what it means to be the church. But I would just say this idea there's a visible church and an invisible church is not biblical. There's only one church that Jesus speaks of, not two.
There are a couple of key mistakes I think that non-Catholic Christians make when understanding church history. And I admit that I made these same mistakes as an evangelical Christian. And it was really once I began to read deeply from church history and the church fathers in their totality that I realized it. And I think one of the main mistakes is to kind of pick and choose sources. So I was having a friendly debate with an evangelical friend of mine on the Eucharist, and he presented these quotes from the early church to show that certain figures at certain times wrote things that sounded like they didn't believe in the real presence of the Eucharist, as we Catholics believe today. But what I realized is that if you read church history in its totality, not just reading selected quotations from select writers, I mean, you see a blindingly obvious witness to what the church as a whole believed about the Eucharist. And my point here is, I think the same can probably be said about the papacy. Like, critics would point to maybe more recent history and say, well, the Pope consolidated his power. Maybe it was very political, and maybe it was very, very recent, or during the Middle Ages, or even more recently. And I'm thinking here of Protestant scholar Jerry Walls, who recently argued that there's actually a Catholic consensus among Catholic scholars that the papacy was perhaps cooked up later in history. But I think, again, if you look at the thread of history, you can see, since the beginning, a Christ-established church, as we've been talking about here, with the Pope at its earthly head. And this is a historical thing, not recently just kind of cooked up, right? Am I right in saying that?
Yeah. So I'd say for a longer version of my response to Dr. Jerry Walls, I just did a piece for Word on Fire. Where I respond to him, and I think it's called How Strong is the Strongest Argument Against Catholicism? Because that's what he calls it. He calls it the strongest argument against Catholicism. And he basically says, number one, everything boils down to the papacy. And then number two, there was no papacy in the first two centuries. And I would say number one is true, and number two is false. Everything does boil down to the papacy, but his arguments against the papacy are pretty darn weak. And his arguments against the papacy I don't know how far down this you want to go. I'm happy to go really far down this. I wrote a really long response, and as you can tell, I get excited about this topic. But maybe I can say just generally, as early as our records go, when people describe the Diocese of Rome or the Church of Rome and its relationship to other churches, they speak and act as if it has a special authority over other churches. So you see this in one really obvious case in 180 when St. Irenaeus, he talks about how all of the apostolic churches, meaning all of the churches started by apostles or by those associated with the apostles, that'd be like Alexandria, which is started by St. Mark, who is the translator and scribe to St. Peter. Also the evangelist. So they all kept really good records, what were called rolls of bishops, where they would keep track of everyone who'd ever ruled over their city, over their local church. And they did this partly to show that they were, in fact, Orthodox, that they were, in fact, apostolic, that they were founded by these apostles, that it was unlikely that early on that they would be teaching heresy, given that an apostle founded them. So it was one of the ways that they pointed to their own orthodoxy, like keeping careful track of this. So as early as 180, we have him talking about this. Tertullian talks about this in 200. In 160, there's a chronicler called Hegesippus who talks about this. But we only have him in Eusebius because the originals have been lost to us. But we have lots of references, even in the second century, to this practice going on. And so you have, first of all, that. Second of all, you have him saying, this is Irenaeus now in 180, saying that he's going to list every bishop of Rome from the time of Peter forward. And the reason he chooses Rome is he says it's necessary for everyone to agree with this church on account of its preeminent authority. That's 180. But go back about 90 years to about 96. You have Clement of Rome, who is listed as the third bishop of Rome after Peter in Irenaeus's list. You have Clement of Rome writing to the Corinthians, settling an internal dispute within their church. Now, this is fascinating for a few reasons. Number one, at the beginning of the letter, Clement apologizes that it's taken so long to write the response because they've been under persecution in Rome. So we don't know when the Corinthians wrote to the Romans, but we know that they wrote, and we know they wrote well enough before 96 that it was like almost embarrassing to be that tardy in responding. Number two, we know this is while the Apostle John is still alive, because John dies in about 100. He's just written Revelation in about 90. So David, there's a living apostle. Corinth is in the east. Rather than writing to Patmos in the east to John, they write to Clement in Rome, in the West, to settle an internal dispute they're having about the people not submitting to the leadership of the church. That points to there being a special office in the Church of Rome that can settle things, even while an apostle is alive. One of the best arguments I always thought against the papacy, one of the things that stumped me for years was, well, what would have happened back in the early days when the other apostles were still alive after Peter died? And we have an actual answer to that question in history, because the Corinthians show us that they still treated the Pope, the successor of Peter, as having this preeminent authority, even while John was alive as an apostle. So that's 96 AD. Dr. Jerry Wallace claims that there isn't a papacy until probably like 180. And that is an insane view if you read the actual evidence from before 180, when you see like tons and tons. And so the last thing I'd say about that is, one of the major congregation dividing disputes within Protestantism has been about the structure of the church. Like literally the reason Reformed Baptists aren't Reformed Presbyterians is because they disagree about the structure of the church. The reason Congregationalists aren't Presbyterians, aren't Episcopalians, is because of the structure of the church. This is an enormous issue in Protestantism. It's an enormous issue within Catholicism. It's just one that we agree on. But it's this idea. This is not like a small, we can agree to disagree, because this is something that by definition is going to divide a church. If you can't agree on the structure and authority and leadership of the church, you can't be under the same leadership because you don't agree with it. So it's like there's a maybe the only exception I can think of is this weird relationship the Church of Scotland has with the Church of England, where the Church of Scotland is basically presbyteral and the Church of England is Anglican, and yet they're both kind of nominally under the Queen, but sort of doing their own thing. So that'd be like the closest you get to an exception. And that's like a weird royal politics. You know, there's a whole other explanation for that. And even that was really bloody to get there. So the idea that someone like Dr. Walls has to make is that this happened in the first 200 years of Christianity. Because as soon as we see the papacy, it's there. It's fully formed. There's no controversy around it. There's no argument. There's nobody saying, hey, this shouldn't be here. This doesn't exist. You have universal disrecognition that, yeah, the Bishop of Rome is here. Yeah, he's got a special role, special office. We're supposed to believe that happened by them taking something that the apostles actually set up. They set up like this Protestant style thing. And at some point, some guy came along and put himself over that as like the sole bishop of the city. And nobody complained about it. Nobody objected to it. Nobody even wrote about it to acknowledge like, hey, remember how this didn't used to be like this. And instead, as soon as we find any records, people are like, this is how it's always been. It's gone all the way back to the apostles. You have to reject literally all of the early witnesses who talk about this and say everybody is lying or delusional about their own very recent history. Like, to believe Walls's claim that this happens in like 180, you have to believe Irenaeus is lying in 180. And I have no idea what you do with these other people writing in like 160 who are before this. You know, like, you see the idea, like, this would be something that would be an enormous shift, and yet there's literally zero evidence for it. No one says there are multiple bishops per church. You go back even further to Ignatius of Antioch writing in 107, and he talks repeatedly about there being a bishop per church. So anyway, I know it's kind of a long answer, but the idea is, like, the papacy is like, it is rock solid historically, and anyone who says it isn't is expecting something that isn't going to be there in the evidence, because we only have a handful of documents from that period. Like, to the extent we don't have great evidence for the papacy, it's only in the periods of time when we don't have great evidence for anything, because there's not very many papyri that are left undestroyed.
They didn't back up their hard drive.
Yeah, exactly.
I love how passionate you are about this, because I am so passionate with this as well, and I don't want to get too like working each other up here, but maybe it's fine. This is what we believed as evangelical Christians about the early church was what we saw in the book of Acts, and that was it. It cut off there, and that was kind of it. And that's the case for many evangelical Christians, many Protestant Christians, and that's why some of these things aren't even really thought about. The papacy and those kind of things. You imagine the early church as this kind of idyllic group of Christians meeting in little, in upper rooms, kind of meeting in secret, no kind of structure. But even if you read Acts of the Apostles, you see that vision of the early church is not accurate. So, I mean, it wasn't even as if I was reading Acts and going, yeah, the church was unstructured and was meeting in upper rooms and persecuted and hiding, and there was no bishops and there were no priests and there were no all this hierarchy and structure. I wasn't. I was believing the interpretation of others of how the early church looked. But if you critically read the Acts of the Apostles, if you actually read it, Joe, you know this is true. And this is what I can understand. There's tons of structure in there. There's a Council of Jerusalem where Peter stands up and makes the decision. There's all these hints, all these very clear markers that this church is a hierarchical, is a visible, united, structured in a certain way. So, I mean, you don't even have to get into, in my opinion, the early church fathers and the history of the early church to see that this church was not this unstructured, willy-nilly, social justice kind of everyone in the upper room praying together, breaking bread together, living together. It wasn't just that. There was a structure and these things, and the papacy emerged from this. I mean, and then you go from there into the early church fathers and the witnesses of the early Christians, and like you said, it isn't as if it was this unstructured kind of egalitarian church and one person took over. Even reading the Acts of the Apostles, I feel like you really have a hard time arguing that, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's worth pointing out that really, like, prior to Jan Hus and John Wycliffe, nobody thought this is what Acts said. Nobody thought this is what the Acts of the Apostles said. And it's like, you don't have, like, that view. There's this idea that there's this kind of view that, like, oh, well, I'm just reading the Bible the way it was originally written, and you guys are reading it through a hermeneutical lens. And it's like, no, you're reading it through a lens too. You just maybe are less aware that you're reading it through a lens. And that lens is way newer. That lens is historically unsupported. And that lens is contradicted by a mound of historical evidence. You mentioned Acts. I would actually add to that also Revelation 1 and 2. There is like one angel per church, per city. that's like a guardian angel of the church in that city that points to there being a unified church in each city. Now, could someone reject that argument? Sure. But I think it certainly is at least suggestive of there being not 20 different denominations all competing for the same thing. We just don't see that. We don't see, like, again, the excommunication we see in 1 Corinthians and in 2 Corinthians points to that there was only one church in Corinth. In Acts, the repeated references to the church at fill in the blank city. There's this idea of not a church at that city, but there's like the church, and here's where it's present there. But go back to Acts 15, because I think that's really fascinating. I love the council, but I think there's something kind of subtle in there that goes on with it. When they send the letter to the Gentile believers, one of the things that they say is, it seemed good to the apostles and the elders, the whole church, to choose men from among them and send them to Antioch with Paul and Barnabas. So the first thing you have is the church acting in this kind of decisive, top-down, authoritative sort of way. They're commissioning people and sending them. And they send them with a letter saying it seemed good for us to send this. And they basically apologize that some have gone out without instruction and caused dissension. Now, that bit about them going out without permission or without instruction, like they're going out without the authority of the visible church and just teaching whatever they think is right. And they're not praised for this like innovative proclamation of the gospel. No, they're condemned for breaking from like the structure and unity and organization of the church. Now, we see this in other ways as well. For instance, in Romans 10, I believe it is, when St. Paul talks about the importance of proclaiming the gospel, one of the things he says just in passing is, well, how can they preach unless they are sent? Now, that is a critical kind of assumption he is coming to the conversation with that modern Protestants don't agree with. Because the modern Protestant view is like, well, if you feel like you're inspired by God, you can go and preach it. I mean, now granted, again, speaking in very broad brushes, a lot of Protestants are going to say, that's not really us. We don't do that. But if you go back to the origin of their denomination, chances are it was somebody who felt the personal call to found this thing on their own kind of charismatic authority. Now, again, a really informed debate would take much more like nuance and all of that. I'm speaking generally here. But as a general thing, there's this idea that you can't even preach unless you're sent. And who are you sent by? You're sent by the visible church. All of this is pointing to the idea that there's a visible structured church that governs every aspect of the Christian life. And you read Ignatius, again, writing like 107, like 7 years after John has died. And he treats it as a norm that you're to do nothing without the permission of the bishop. That is huge, right? Like the two possibilities are one, that is what the early Christians believed because that's what's actually true and that's what was actually taught by Christ and by the apostles. Or two, Orthodox Christianity had like the lifespan of a horsefly and just died out super quickly. And yet Protestantism has somehow lasted 500 years. Now that second view, it basically says Luther is more effective than Jesus. And I think that doesn't hold. Like it just doesn't make sense that that would be the right answer. So I think it's going to be the view that like, no, maybe the early church actually knew more about what the early apostles said than people looking on it 2000 years later. Like maybe we should actually believe them when they said, yeah, this is how our church was set up. This is how it was structured. This is how we're supposed to live ordinary daily life. And that changes the whole notion, the whole debate.
I remember reading St. Francis de Sales, who I think was Bishop of Geneva at the time during the Reformation, kind of in the hotbed of the whole reform movement. And I remember reading his letters that he wrote to some of these reformers. And one of the things that he said at one point was, who gives you the authority to start this church? And he meant like an actual literal church. This reformer would start a church, buy a building, get the congregation, start teaching from the Bible. And I thought, what is he talking about? Like, 'cause at the time I hadn't thought a lot about authority at this point, but I came to understand the importance of this question. I mean, he was seeing this church as being a unified church under the Pope, the Catholic Church, and these guys just getting a Bible and just opening up hanging a shingle and opening up a church. This is so normalized now in Protestant Christianity. It's not even a thing you really think about, I think. The idea of being sent by denomination or inspired to go start a church is just kind of how things work in Protestant Christianity, apart from even denominations now, in many cases. I went to a non-denominational church for a good chunk of my evangelical lifespan. But back then, as Reformation was starting, that was the question. Like, well, who gives you the authority just to do this? And that question made a lot of sense because it was just being done. It was when it was started as it started to happen, it was like, no, you can't just go and do that. Like, the Pope did not approve you to buy that building and start this church. It was a live issue then that I think now has kind of become dulled and mundane. But the question, I think, is still equally there, right?
Yeah, that line from Romans that I was mentioning earlier about who can preach unless they've been sent, I'm stealing that directly from Francis de Sales. He talks about this, and if you want to read the book, it's called Catholic Controversies, where he has like the arguments that he would slip under the doors in the House of Geneva. So the people in Geneva were forbidden to hear him preach because he was so effective as a Catholic apologist. And he had such a heart for his people. He's the Bishop of Geneva, and he's outlawed by, like, upon pain of death from even being in Geneva. And so what he does instead is he just like makes these pamphlets and slides them under the door. And something like 80,000 people end up coming back to Catholicism. It's this enormous kind of religious revival. So southern France, which is part of his diocese at the time, he's like pretty Catholic even now. It's been through a lot, obviously. Like, secularism hasn't been good to the whole area. And Catholicism is actually the single largest religion in Geneva these days. This was literally like the capital of Calvinism. This is where Calvin was. And so there was kind of a Catholic religious revival, and Francis de Sales plays a big role. So it's worth reading what he has to say. Like, if you're a Protestant listening to this and you're just wondering, like, what are these guys talking about? I just refer you to Catholic Controversies. I didn't expect to promote a different book on here, but it's so good. It's so good. And it's life changing. Like, once you get into this question, he says, look, there's two ways you can be sent. Either you can be sent directly by God, the way like a prophet is. But whenever that happens in the Old Testament, they can prove it with signs and wonders. And if whenever that happens in the New Testament, they can prove it with signs and wonders. This is the last part of Mark 16, right? The signs accompany. In Jolo, West Virginia, there's a snake handling church that is I think called something something in signs accompany. And it's based on this line in like the very end of Mark's gospel. But the idea was the apostles had certain ways of proving that they were actually sent directly by God. And one of those is that they could like handle snakes and they could drink poison and it wouldn't hurt them. And they could perform miracles and all this. And so Francis Sales is like, so you're obviously not that. Like, you guys aren't doing miracles. You're not performing all of these like incredible feats. There's nothing like that. Nor do the reformers claim that they are. The other way people are sent is immediately instead of immediately. You're either sent immediately by God or you're sent immediately, meaning through the body of Christ, the church. And that's what we see in Acts 15. They're sending people, not in the sense that like Moses is sent, but in this other sense in which they're able to call people as the church. But you go out without that authority from the church and you're actually going against God. Well, here, a lot of people today are saying, well, my local denomination sent me and my local denomination called me. I was ordained. But who called them and who called the person who called them? And you go back far enough and you realize that there's at some point a break. So in this sense, imagine like a power cord. If you cut a power cord 10 feet before the light's not going to work. Doesn't matter if the cut is an inch away or 10 feet away or wherever it is. If there's anything separating it from the origin, you don't have it doesn't work. It's not a valid cord. So likewise, someone who didn't have the ability to be called in the first place doesn't have the ability to call you. And that's true of the next generation, the next generation, the next generation. This is why apostolic succession is a thing. Like, this is why that matters, because it's this idea that you're either called by the church or you're not supposed to be doing this thing and like pretending to be exercising church leadership, because that's just not how it works. And that's throughout like every description of the church in the New Testament.
That's fantastic. I have one more question for you. And we may have answered this in all kinds of ways in this conversation. I think we have. But for the listener, and I was here, who's okay with their Bible, with their church, they've got things figured out. Why? Why the papacy? Why is it necessary or important or useful? What would you say?
Yeah. So I think we all want to be united as Christians. Like, I have a tremendous amount of respect for the person you just described, right? And I want to be in full communion with them. But we can't be in full communion right now because there's some huge issues we disagree about. Like, is the Eucharist the body and blood, soul, and divinity of Jesus Christ or not? That's a big issue, because either I'm worshiping bread and that's bad, or they're missing an opportunity to worship Jesus Christ in the flesh, and that's bad too. Like, you need to either fall down in adoration or reject it as idolatry. There's not really a good middle ground. That's just one issue, right? And so having some sort of way of finding out which of those two extremes is it, that seems important. Now, I've just taken one doctrine. You can go down the list. Praying to Mary is either the fulfillment of Luke's gospel that all generations will call me blessed, or it's repugnant idolatry. So one of those has to be right. That's a pretty big issue. We can keep going, right? Like, it's so this idea of, like, is being out of union with the church a sin? Well, if what Jesus is saying in John 17 means we need to be all fully in communion with one another, if we need to be, as Acts describes, as one heart and one mind, then yeah, it is. Like, we need to actually agree on the same body of teachings. We need to actually be in full communion with one another. And we need to all be able to share one sacramental meal. 1 Corinthians 10 says we are one body because we partake of the one loaf. Now, Paul does not mean that there's a literal loaf of bread that he and the Corinthians and everybody else was all eating from. That's obviously wrong. The one loaf is the same one loaf that's in the boat with the apostles. When it says Jesus are in the apostles are in the boat, and there's just the one loaf. It's Jesus himself. He is the bread come down from heaven, as John 6 says. And so to be able to commune with one another, to be able to share the sacramental meal with one another, to be fully united, that needs to be a burning desire on every Christian's heart, or you don't love your neighbor well enough, and you don't love, like, following the commands of God well enough. And that needs to be in my heart and your heart, wherever you may find yourself. And so then the question of, well, does that mean we all be united around the Pope, or is there some other way we can all be one? That should be a question everybody takes very, very seriously.
And I think we know where you land on that question.
Yeah, I think we do.
Okay, the book is fantastic. Where can people go to get their hands on it? You're doing all kinds of things. I mentioned a few in the intro. Where can they go to find out all these different things you're doing, what you're up to, and get their hands on this incredible book?
Sure. Okay, so the book is at shop.catholic.com, or if you go to amazon.com, I have another book called Who Am I, Lord? Finding Your Identity in Christ, which is just like looking at Christology and this universal quest for human identity. Very different kind of book. That's also on Amazon. That one's through Our Sunday Visitor. My blog is Shameless Popery, shamelesspopery.com. You can see a little bit of a hint of where I fall on the Pope there. And then I work for School of Faith, schooloffaith.com. And we do a daily rosary, dailyrosary.net. And then I have a podcast called The Catholic Podcast, or CATHPOD.com, CathPod.com. I know it's a lot of kind of blurbs right at the end there. I try to keep busy, but there you go. That's what I've got.
That's great. Joe, this was an amazing conversation. I think people are going to absolutely love it. I mean, I'm going to go back and listen to it afterwards, because there's so much in there that I feel like you said that I have to take in again and digest and think about again to really get to the meat of it, which I think is fantastic. I mean, there is, as I mentioned before, and I think this is just important to underscore one last time, we didn't, as Catholics, invent the papacy yesterday. I mean, there's this rich tapestry that goes all throughout the Old Testament, the New Testament. It's there. It's historical. It's beautiful. It's wonderful. I'm telling you what you already know, but
I mean, we're only scratching the surface, right? Like, I really want to talk about, like, Peter as high priest in the New Testament, because there's really fascinating stuff there. And even some Protestant scholars who are like, yeah, there seems to be something here about Peter fulfilling the old high priestly role. But we're not even going to touch on that. I'll just say it's on the book. It is a beautiful tapestry. And you've been an amazing, you've more than exceeded the idea of being a cordial Catholic. But sorry, please continue.
Well, thank you. And I'll have to have you back. And I'll have to refer listeners to buy your book, which is a good thing to do. Thank you so much for being here. Thank you for the work that you do for the church. God bless you and your family. And thanks so much, Joe, for being here today.
Thank you tremendously. I really appreciated being able to share this time with you.
Yeah, it's been great. Thank you once again for listening to The Cordial Catholic. I hope you loved that conversation. It was one of my favorites. I gotta be honest, guys. I loved talking to Joe, and as soon as the interview ended, we agreed to do it again sometime soon. It was fantastic. Hopefully you liked it too. TheCordialCatholic.com for show notes for this show and for blog articles that I have written, and show notes for past shows as well. It's TheCordialCatholic.com. At Cordial Catholic on Twitter, please follow me, and The Cordial Catholic on Facebook. CordialCatholic@gmail.com is our email address. Please do write to me. Tell me who you are, why you're listening, and where you're listening from. I love hearing from you guys. I love your questions, your comments, your feedback, and I write back to everything that I can as soon as I can. So thank you so much for writing into the show. I love your emails, guys. If you could follow or subscribe to the show wherever you find it, if you can leave a rating or a review, just do it right now in your Apple Podcasts app or on Stitcher. I would love that. That helps to push the podcast out to new people and to grow the audience and to expand the mission of evangelization that kind of underpins this whole thing. And hey, tell a friend, tell some family. Word of mouth is great too. And this episode, I think, is a fantastic kind of explanation of the papacy. Hope you liked it. Patreon.com/cordialcatholic for a monthly donation. $5 or more a month donors are entered automatically into a draw for free books every month. Or paypal.me/cordialcatholic for a one-time donation. All goes right back into the show, guys. Thanks for listening. I'm praying for you. Please pray for me, guys, and I'll talk to you again next week. God bless. This show is brought to you in a special way by our co-producer patrons over at patreon.com/cordialcatholic. A special thanks to Ellie and Tom, Kelvin and Susan, Stephen, Suzanne and Victor, Phil, Noah, Nicole, Michelle, Jordan, John, James, Gina, and Aram for your special support at the co-producer tier and making this thing possible. You guys are fantastic. God bless and thanks for your support.